Okay, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ryan Kelsey. I'm one of the co-chairs of this seminar on new media teaching and learning. I want to welcome you to our session this afternoon. I guess it's the fifth of this academic calendar. We got one more to go after this. But I'm just going to make a couple comments about the format of the meeting for those that haven't been to one of these before, and then turn it over to Mark Philipson, who will introduce our guests. Typically, the format for this session is our speakers will talk for about 45 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for a Q&A, half an hour, something like that, and then I think they'll have a few closing remarks to say, and that'll be it. And we've promised them that we'll get them on the road by 5:30 so they can make their way back up to Boston. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Philipson, who will introduce our people from MIT. Take it away, Mark.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Happy spring break to everyone. We are towards the end of a two-year series of conversations in these seminars, and we're thinking about the ways in which objects might move between repositories, learning environments, and the open web. And we've approached this question in a variety of ways. The project we're going to be learning more about today, MIT's Visualizing Cultures project, is a particularly interesting case study that engages all three of these areas of interest, I think. Objects moving between repositories or collections. This is this project draws on objects from various collections. Objects moving into learning environments. This is a project that offers not only well-presented and contextualized images of Japanese of representations of Japan since the 19th century, but it also puts these images within topical units, many offered by today's presenter, John Dower, the project's director. Many of these images are accompanied by a substantial bibliography, by lesson plans, by videos, and such. So it does an energetic job of placing these into a learning environment, and it also makes these images available on the open web, which touches off some controversy when the images represent some of the darker aspects of history, as the project website puts it, images of violence, intolerance, racism, etc. I'm sure we'll hear a little bit about that today as well. The presenters, we have two presenters, Professor John Dower, I just mentioned, the project director. He's a professor of Japanese history at MIT. He's the author of numerous books, including War Without Mercy, Race and Power in the Pacific War, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award, Embracing Defeat, Japan in the Wake of World War II, which was just showered with prizes, including the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, and here at Columbia, the Bancroft Prize. And he's currently working on a book called Cultures of War, Pearl Harbor, Hiroshima, 9/11 in Iraq, which is a comparative study of the Pacific War, Islamic Jihad, and 9/11, and the Iraq War. He is accompanied by Scott Shunk in the back there, the program director for Visualizing Culture. Scott is a friend of the center. He presented with us last year at our Video Education and Open Content conference. I actually was honored to be on the same panel as Scott. He waited patiently for me to stop talking so he could present, and history is repeating itself.
Thank you very much for inviting me and for showing up today. I got a little tour of what you're doing, and I'm very happy to join you. I wanted to tell you what we're doing on the project. I'm not a tech person at all. I'm a historian, and so I come into this from someone very interested in how we can use the new technologies to do both education and outreach, and something in particular that we become increasingly interested in, and that is image-driven scholarship. Because there is an opportunity to change the way we do scholarship as historians and humanists and social scientists online, and I think we're just beginning to work out some of the problems, which are very complicated. And it's very hard not only to work out the technology, but to persuade colleagues that the visual world is indeed an important world for us to use as scholars, and that this is a new way of doing it. So we're doing something very close to what we're doing. And I'm of the generation that began as a historian using slides in the classroom, which I had copied from books, and they only existed in the classroom, and then they got filed away. I'm of that generation. And, of course, now we have the opportunity to make them available in different ways, widely available in different ways. But what you learned when you showed those materials in the classroom was they took on a life of their own. They don't just illustrate the visuals. If to a historian like myself, don't just illustrate things you were talking about. They have their own, they drive you in their own directions. And so I think we now have the opportunity technologically and intellectually to open up this area. MIT in around 2001, 2002 introduced OpenCourseWare, which was to put all MIT courses online in Creative Commons available to the world free. And when that was created, the person who is the co-project director with me, Shigeru Miyagawa, was on the committee that created OCW, and we decided we would do something different. We would use OCW as a platform to create a project that could go out to the world. In other words, there was no such course as Visualizing Cultures. We created a course, but it was really to have a platform to reach the world. So everything online that is up there is available and can be downloaded and used in any way for educational purposes. That's the whole thing about Creative Commons. We named it Visualizing Cultures, and the units that are up now are focusing mostly on Japan and the modern world, but many of them, for example, will begin with Perry going and opening up Japan. So it's U.S., Japan. Many of them involve European perceptions of Asia, Japan interacting with China, Japan interacting with Russia, and so on. In my view, but this is a different subject, cultures, I don't think of it, even though I'm a Japan specialist, as capital C cultures, East, West, Japan, Chinese culture, Japanese culture. I don't think really in those ways. The cultures that interest me are more transnational. Imperialism, colonialism, racism, consumerism, pop culture, and things where we can break down those boundaries. But to get the focus and to move into the area that we knew well, and I know better than anything else, the focus up to now is Japan. We're now doing developing units on China, Philippines, and Korea, and we're now into the 20th century. When you do history, because of IP issues, it's much easier to work with the 19th century because so many of the materials are free of copyright issues. Now, as we get into the 20th century, we have more problems. And one of the things that we have begun to do is to partner with different institutions like museums or collections or big archives in private hands that have materials that are really, really useful, and to bring them out so that we can clear the IP issues. In other words, they have the rights to 20th century materials, and through a partnership, we just get the rights, and they also provide the images to us. So that's one of the things that we are doing now. And a lot of what we're doing just involves persuading people that the kind of work you do online is not a zero-sum game, but there's a world out there. I think we're facing a revolution in many ways, but up until recently, museums and collections would always hold their materials. Everyone wanted to hold their materials, and there was a notion that if we give them to you to use, we're losing something. We're losing some kind of proprietary right. We're losing, you're getting something free. There's no sense, it's still a big struggle, that it's a win-win game. If we get materials from you, we give your name, it comes out with it, it draws attention to your collections. It's another thing with publishers. Most publishers of print texts are reluctant to put some of that stuff online because the notion is, oh, the sales of our books will drop. You know, my view, they sell about 700 books. They don't sell a lot of books, in my view. And, of course, it's win-win. If you put out some of the graphics and did a great site, it would call attention to the book to the thousands of people who would use the site. A lot of education necessary to do things. The units that are up now are all being rebuilt, and the rebuild will be... because we've learned a lot in terms of presentation. And we'll show you units now that are rebuilt. They will all be rebuilt by May 1st, Scott Thompson. And you won't see him nodding in front of you, and I will call on you if I need to. Incidentally, please interrupt me if you want to ask questions. I'm very deaf. So I'll have to walk up close to you. But I'm happy to be interrupted if you wish. In the new bill, this is these are the units that are up. And then if you scan over them, you will see what the topic is. So this is the first unit. We did black ships. We moved on. That was Perry's visit to Japan. And then we moved on to Prince. Then we moved on to the pioneer photographer Japan, did early photography, did prints in the woodblock prints of Japan up to the turn of the century, did units on the Russo-Japanese War. Some of these, and then 2005 was the 60th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I do a lot of work on the war, and we did units on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We're doing much more now, 20th century, but these are the units that are up now, and I just wanted to move in and show you how we're structured, what we're trying to do. I came in, I'm not very wired, personally, but I came in a feeling that there is a way to put up visual material, but they have to be wrapped around text. And I wanted to wed text with the visuals. And it led us in many, many interesting directions. And initially people said the web isn't so adapted to the text. But in fact, I really wanted to put very smart text and wrap it around the pictures. And of course, the beauty was you could put up everything you wanted in the original color. There's no limit. And it led to many pedagogic things that we learned over the course of time, how to present them, how to caption them for the people who are scanning, how you can spin off and come back. You know, you can take little detours and put things up. And we were very ambitious. We wanted to be elegant, not only intellectually, but visually. And so it probably takes 6 months to do a unit. And we have a full-time staff of three, designer, program manager, and deep coder. And that 6 months is after the lawyers. And the lawyers often take 6 months to a year before they'll agree to let you use their images. Because once you've gone to the curators, then it goes up to another group of people who aren't used to sharing materials. But we've made many breakthroughs, and I think the thing is that in time, this will become commonplace. We made a big breakthrough with the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And they let me in. And the breakthroughs work in several ways. They digitize for you. And the one unit I went in, I went through an entire collection, and they digitized for me 150 images. I made a terrible mistake. They said, how many images would you want? And I said, 150. And they said, okay. Ridiculous. You always say three times more than you might need. And that was what it was. Then the other thing they're starting to do and which we are learning how to do is many collections have internally digitized images. They're internally digitized, and it used to be in museums that they would say, we can't let this out because we don't have perfect metadata. We're not quite sure who the author is. We're not quite sure, of the dates of this. This is still, we can't let it out. And they're changing now. So you can go in and, for example, we can't hook you up a database of 20,000 images at the MFA of a certain collection. We can now tap into that database. It's a goal of mine. And so we're learning in various ways. But we have a very close working relationship with the Sackler Fria Gallery and the Smithsonian, which is one of the great Asia collections. And once you make the break, then the next museum's easier. Because you go off to Peabody Essex Museum and they say, we can't give away our images. We say, well, we've worked this out with the MFA. We're doing it with Sackler. And then they begin to say, wait, maybe this is the way things are going. And then the next time you go somewhere else, it gets easier and easier. Also, you get the boilerplate warrior-y language a little bit clearer, which is understandable. What is the understanding of using it? We began with, I wanted to show you some of the features. This is the new rebuilt image. There are several features to a unit. They've evolved. One is what we call a core exhibit. So we go into the Perry unit, Black Ships and Sunrise. It's the first unit we ever did. And the core exhibit is basically a text which weaves around the graphics at the moment that the graphics are prepared. And I'm not an art historian. We're not doing art history per se. I'm doing social, cultural, whatever you wish to call it, history. So we go down and we do that, but I think if you go back up a minute, Scott, we also hook in videos. So in the new rebuild, you can get at the video very quickly. So, for example, this is a video that was done of me introducing this.
Black Ships and Samurai. I'm John Doe.
So we can do the videos on the set. I love this business because I don't even use email. I'm the only person at MIT that doesn't even use email. But I'm getting all of this grand vocabulary from Scott, basically. And one of the things I learned is reverse engineering. Because we got up this site on Paris, and people said, that's great, why don't you make an installation? So we went from the site and made an installation based on all the stuff in the site that toured all over the U.S. and there's another set that toured Japan. And that's what that was, me walking through. Then if you go on and we do this text, that was him saying there was a letter that introduced Perry. It didn't come up?
Yeah, it did.
The letter came up?
It did.
Oh, I didn't see it. I'm sorry. We can bring the texts that we talk about, the real written text also can come up. So these are some of the things we did with Black Ship Scroll. We started to learn those then. One of the things when Perry went over, one of the things that was done was I thought it was going to be a very controllable project because Commodore Perry, the American, went over in 1853 to Japan and he basically was a closed country and he said, I'm going to come back. If you don't sign a treaty, we have our gunboats and we will use them. He's gunboat diplomacy. He came back in 1854 and was there a number of weeks and they signed the treaty. So that's when Japan opens to the world. Now, I thought it was a contained subject because, and for a historian, it's a beauty, because you have a moment in history that's very, very, very important. And Perry brings his artists with him. So it's a contained group of images that are coming out on the American side because they're the artists he has brought with him. the Japanese are responding very ad hoc. There's no official response. So there's all sorts of drawings and things being done on the Japanese side, but I figured we could track everyone down. My ambition was to find every graphic that existed. And we came fairly close, probably, but we gave up at a certain point. We also tapped both rare books and archival materials, and we ended up getting permissions from between 35 and 50 sources. And it's in Blavitz in Japanese, and that was just too much to handle for the staff of a couple of people. That was just too much to handle. After that, we saw the need to partner with someone who had the collection, because you just, if you're a small operation, to clear, particularly if you're working in a couple of languages, that was formidable. But one of the pieces of art that existed was a 35-foot scroll of the Peri-Visit called the Black Ship Scroll. It only existed for the public to see in a book done by Oliver Stapler about 30 years ago, 40 years ago. But it's absolutely popular anonymous artist who does who did a scroll of what the Peri visit was like. What we did was, there are actually five copies. There are five Black Ship Scrolls, which we don't know which is the master, but they were copied at the time in five different versions. We have a couple of them up there, but this is the best one that we could get hold of. And it was in the Honolulu Museum of Art, and they said, sure, we'll share it with you, and it came to us in about 35 slides. So we were able to recreate the scroll, in other words, to recreate something. Now, you can never, ever see this kind of a thing, even in the original. You go to a museum, and you can't open a 35-foot scroll in the museum. You open to maybe 10 feet of it or something, and that's what you display. And, of course, the other thing is you can't study it. So we did this. You want to show the other version of it?
Sure.
We did the scroll. We recreated it. No, I'm thinking of the yep. grid and the interactive grid. Then we recreated this way, and then you can close in on every particular image, and then we provide summaries. This is one of the wittier ones. Not the kind of thing that you get from the formal text. And so it moves you into pop culture, which of course is another area that we're recognizing as so important in history. You no need to go in, Scott, but if you go through something like this, you go through very witty things. Here's American sailors dancing, they're inebriated, and here's American sailors mingling with local people, and they're having fun. They have funny scenes. But then the same scroll shows Peri and Adams, his second in command, as demonic figures, the hairy barbarians. And then this is Adams' son, who's, of course, maybe none of them saw the people, who is described as a perfect Japanese boy. And remember, he's a perfect Japanese youth, and he's pale, and he's a good in martial arts, and he's good in poetry, and he's gentle, and so on and so forth. And it's just this incredible hodgepodge. What happens with this kind of thing is that when you do history, you begin to deal with constructions of self and other. It's always best if you're moving around. And they get complicated. Because the natural thing to do is say, and Peri looked like the hairy barbarian, and the Japanese all thought that they were being invaded by hairy barbarians, and they all became very frantic and upset. That's not true. That's half true. And so you can do complexity in very interesting ways with the images. We also learn to do things like recreating woodblock prints. No, the woodblock print. So we could just create things to show how a woodblock print is made. This is what's on the block, and this is what happens when you put the block on, and you move through. They use 10 different blocks to make this print. So we're able to do these kind of things once again. You can also try to do it with a video. These are the kind of things we were able to do. When we finished Black Ship and Samurai, we realized we couldn't keep doing this. We couldn't keep going to 40, 50 sources, museums, and asking for the digitized image. So that's when we moved on to particular collections. I want to show you what we then moved on to with photography, because one of the cultures that we deal with is cultures of changing media. So when you move, and this is fascinating, because everything is changing as media is changing. So as photography comes in, you get into a whole new media. As mass production, reproduction comes in, you get into a whole new different media and different forms. And the problem with going online with photographs is that most websites look sort of like they've dumped the shoebox onto the site. And I glaze over. I mean, I've seen a lot of pictures. I really stop to glaze over. And they have no rhyme or reason. They're just kaplunk. And you have an enormous number of photographs. So what we're trying to do is give form and structure to how images work. And you say, okay, how were foreigners seeing Japan through photographs? And it's photographs by foreigners and by Japanese showing themselves to others. You always have to be very careful about stereotypes. You always have to be very careful about Western racist stereotypes, because often there are people on each side being represented who are contributing in active ways to those same images. And so we get into something that's, of course, fascinating in itself, which is tourism, representations of yourself, representations of other. And with photography, you get into very interesting things. For example, in many ways, photography is so highly selective, because the photographers who go to a foreign country always want the real Japan, India, China, wherever. And a real Japan, India, China is something with nothing Western and no foreigners in it. So you go down and you get temples and shrines coming out of your ears. And you only take pictures of the people in primitive traditional trades. And you don't go and get the big guns and the big boats usually. And you certainly don't go in to get the Western factories. And in many ways, it's very interesting. So you're not only into new modes of communication, but the way in which they change our ways of seeing and ways of representation. One of the ways we handle this, the great, great pioneer photographer, foreign photographer in Japan, was a man named Felice Bianco. And he was a great photographer who did the Crimean War, and he went to various countries and he settled in Japan at the exact moment that the old government was overthrown and the modern government was created. Beato, if you go online to usually Beato's sites, you will get the dumped out shoebox. It'll just be a potpourri of images. But Beato also did albums. They were very prized tourist things at the time, and one of them was at Smith College, and one of them that we used was at Dartmouth's Hood Museum, Smith College Museum of Art. So what we have here is what we do is we not only can recreate his selection, but we can recreate the captions that went with this select 50. And this is his captions. So you can give exactly, no editing, don't change the spellings, don't correct mistakes. That boilerplate in the English, boilerplate in the beginning saying, this is unedited and some of it's wrong. But we present it so you can recreate that exactly. And then, what you learn when you do this kind of work, what I learned in any case, is that you can see things better online than often you can, even in the original. Now, it's certainly true, I'm not going to show you what I did. I spent a little bit of time doing woodblock prints at the Museum of Fine Art. I went through 800 or 900 circulars. I looked at every one. That was where I had them digitized, 150 that had never ever been formed to digitize for us. But the ones we got them online, I could see them better because I had more time. I could study. I could close in. We found with the photographs that you can actually draw a person into a photo, by going into a detail first and then pulling back to the real image. The details of those old photographs are extraordinary. And you don't see them, you see them online, that's where you find them, because you can isolate them. So you can go through in another version that we put this up, and you can do the detail. You see, if you just put this up, which is your usual thing, you get it's a very interesting photo. You almost never would get any kind of caption, but this is Giotto's original. But if you move in like that, that becomes interesting. Then you can pull back and say, what was the full picture? Then, one of the pedagogical things, and this, I don't know, may apply to what things that interest you. One of the interesting pedagogical things is to provide huge databases. Now, when I used to teach for many years at Wisconsin-Madison, the library went back 125 years. They had enormous old books, and I used to just throw students into the stacks, going through old books and creating stuff from the raw things. Now I'm at MIT, and MIT's library, as you can imagine, was really built on science and technology and wasn't collecting every old travel book published 100 years ago. And I couldn't move students into visuals. What we try to do is now to teach people how to read the visuals and then give them the huge database that they can go in and then link to an even bigger database that may be in the museum or in another collection, so that they can go in and do research in visual materials in a way you never could before. So we do databases, and then we also do galleries. If you want to hit the galleries
we're in.
On this Giotto unit, Scott. We then give galleries of all the images. In this case, the gallery is no more than what we... actually, it is more, because we didn't feature every one of these in there. And then we can enlarge these way beyond what they even were in the originals, so you can really do close analysis. So this is a world for... You see, it's great for pedagogy. It's great. I mean, you put students into things, and they find things you didn't see. But they also have been led to doing something. And we just find this... there's no way to duplicate this. There's no way you can do it in the print world. It's just a new way of providing a resource for teaching, but also for scholars. So these are the kind of things we were doing on these materials. Then the controversy was a very nasty one, and if someone wants us to get into it, we can get into it later. But I wanted to move into these two units. This has been rebuilt. This is not. A number of years ago, Leonard Lauder of the cosmetics family and fortune donated his personal collection of Japanese postcards. That postcards come onto the world scene around the very beginning of the 1900s, around 1903, 1904. That's when color printing, multicolor printing, becomes available, and international mailing regulations are unified so that postcards start moving around the world. And that introduction of postcards, as it happened, coincided with the moment that Japan became a great imperialist power by defeating Russia in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905. Lauder gives his collection to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. It was a very sought-after collection by a number of museums. It numbers about 25,000, well over 20,000 postcards. It's called Japanese Postcards. And they go from the very first postcards into the early 1930s. I walked over into the museum, because by then we were had a relationship, and they had all these things sitting on the shelves, and what about the shoe boxes? And I'm just walking there, and the first several shoe boxes say, Russo-Japanese War, Japanese postcards, Russo-Japanese War, foreign postcards. It's the only part of his collection that isn't postcards made by the Japanese. And it turns out to be a little short of 2,000 postcards on the Russo-Japanese War. And, okay, you have a moment when mass communication has just changed. Everyone in the world can communicate. The great event in the world is the Russo-Japanese War, because Japan is fighting a Western power and winning. It's the highest of modern technology, and everyone around the world is depicting it. So even more than Perry, what you can do intellectually here is take a single moment and move around it. Not only can you take a single moment and move around it, so we have to, well, the one thing he doesn't have is U.S. postcards. Someone would have to do that. You can get Japanese postcards, Russian postcards, German postcards, French postcards, English postcards, all about the same event. And I had never seen anything like it. I had never been able to move around a subject and get at the eye of the beholder in the same vivid way. And so we did this unit now on the postcards, and here are the Japanese postcards, but it is also probably the world's first, it is the world's first well photograph war. Everyone, these are all the foreigners, military attachés and journalists who are following this war. The whole world is there. There's a little lull, you know. People aren't killing each other elsewhere at that moment. They all go over to Japan to see how to do it and to see this new rising power. And so it becomes the first really well photographed war. I know we have Matthew Brady, and I know we have the Civil War photographs, but this is a little different. This is a modern war. The Japanese have fantastic battleships at the time. So even though we're doing the postcards, we wanted to introduce the fact that the postcards are one medium, the woodblock prints are another medium, which we do in another site. But photography is hitting the world in a serious way. So we take one of the books at the time, came out at the time, and we just do a run of what the photography of the time is like. Now, once again, you know, if you just hold on a picture like this, by blowing it up in this way, it is the big book. And it's the kind of thing you can find in the used bookstores. And even I could have bought some like compelling narratives and that cost tens of thousands of dollars. But you can blow it up and study it and see it in ways that you can't if you share it with your students. So we introduced the photography world, and as you can see, we introduced a lot of the photos at the time. Then we go back from the Russo-Japanese things into the postcards themselves. Now, every unit has different chapters. So this is how we begin with the thing. This is the fun things you can do. For example, they were putting out postcards as sets. So this is three different postcards. So you would collect it. So the postcards become not simply a way of communication, but they also become collector's items, and they're international. Mm-hmm. So people in Japan are sending them to people in Europe, and they're collecting European ones of the same event. And then what you can show, and this is where you put them together, and then you get postcards which seem to be, well, you know, various different kinds of postcards. You put them together in ways that we can. And this is a run of postcards. 1905. This is a run of postcards. 1905. That's mind-boggling. This is mind-boggling to me, technically, artistically. And of course, you see what's happening. Go back a second. Is they're moving into montage, the photography and the traditional kind of Japanese art, and the subject is the great modern battleships. This is a new world. This is a brand new world that everyone, and I never knew it existed. And I've been, you know, doing history for a long time. I'm almost history myself. And you get so many things going on here. And what this is a 10-card series. And the MFA and Lauda never could find card number 10. So we know it's this card. And so we often will sometimes put in a blank where something's missing in the set. If any of you find this card, contact the MFA and you will become very lucky. So these are the kind of things that we can recreate in ways, and of course the postcards, there's no way you could see them and see them in context without going into what we're able to do online. And then let me just show you one more thing. These are what we call, and I've been going into them without introducing them, in addition to a core exhibit, we have what we call visual narrative. So the core exhibit is an essay that I think is, I never write essays thinking this is for X or this is Y. I never really draw a line between K-12 and freshman, or sophomores, or the university. Because middle school and high schools, students with good teachers can handle very complex things. I never draw that line, and I never personally draw the line between pedagogy and scholarship. I think they blur. And so I'm a rotten grant writer, because, and I'm hopeless, everyone else writes the grants, because they say, oh, no, no, we're into pedagogy and you're talking scholarship. Oh, no, 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 we're into scholarship and you're doing pedagogy, and you've actually talked to, you know, K-12 teachers. My God, you know, that's not scholarship. And it's a false distinction in my view. I really think you can have a vision where we go beyond these lines. That first great word can be very, very effective pedagogically. Now, go back a second, Scott. One of the ways, in addition to wrapping that long text around the illustrations, one of the things that we started doing was, you see, a lot of people who go online don't read the texts, which causes problems sometimes. What we after some experiences, that you must then learn how to caption. You can't just, we started out, for example, with Perry just giving the title of the print or the photograph or something in our code number and something. You have to learn how to caption and also how to do things in boxes or blocks or so on. But then we also, because I'm really interested in the way in which the imagery can drive ideas, that you can see things that the word itself fails to convey in the same way. Of course, this may sound commonsensical to many of you. It is not common sense in the field of history or humanities or social science in general. They still don't see the image as a text of equal value in its own right to the written word. But we started to do, in addition to the core exhibit, which is dense, what we call visual narratives, which is where you pick out a theme that can be pulled out of the images, and then you just develop that theme. And they're called visual narratives. Now, one of the things that the postcards, is in the war is 1904, 1905, the postcards are 1904, 1905, and then some from 1906, commemorating the war, the first year anniversary, and so on. What they show is a country that has just become enraptured with its own modernity. And so you get postcards that look like woodblock prints, and you get postcards that sort of seem like realistic paintings, and then you get this theme we just pulled out called Modernizing Propaganda Avant-Garde Postcards, and these are postcards. These are picture postcards of the Russo-Japanese War. Hold on a second. Because of postal conventions back in those days, this side of the postcard was for the address, and this side was for the picture and the illustration and any message you might write and also stamps. So what you get are postcards with messages written on them, and then postcards which were obviously collected. But what's happening is you get a sense of a country. This is a Russian ship in the Japanese postcard. It's a Russian ship. You get a sense of a country that really feels it's arrived in visual, graphic ways that are simply extraordinary. I had simply not grasped it earlier. So once again, the images really drive you in directions that I don't understand. Then you get this very modern image, and we haven't rebuilt the other site, but if you want to just yellow promissory of power, there's those other 800-900 foreign postcards of the Russo-Japanese War that come from around the world. And we do a parallel unit called Yellow Promise, Yellow Peril. And these are the postcards that basically, hold a second, are being done by foreigners. Now, they're fascinating. I don't have the American postcards. I've got English, I mean, Lauder doesn't have the American postcards. I have English. The English are very interesting. There are runs, they're fascinating. For example, some runs will have English language and German language versions. One of the, it's the same run, they're being distributed all over Europe. The British, you cannot generalize once again. The British will have postcards, I could show you while we're running out of time, where the Japanese or the British German sets are depicted as a Victorian statesman. They're very dignified. They're very westernized. And they're treated with great respect. Britain was Japan's ally in the Japanese War. So there's some really respectful, and that is the part of Japan as the Britain of the Pacific, or to Americans, Japan as the Yankees of the Pacific. Plucky little men who are rising up to become great. Then the British, of course, predictably, are as contemptuous as you can be, and there's all the Mikado, the Mikado, the funny little Jap, little J-A-P-P-Y they call it, where they all look like they're in the Mikado, and they're all absolutely clownish, funny figures. So you can't say the British are one or the other, but there's an awful lot of racial looking down on the nose. And this is true of everyone. The French postcards are probably the best, because the French are fundamentally equal opportunity cynics and racists. And so they do a job on the Russians, they do a job on the Japanese, they do great postcards on great politics and so on, but they do a fantastic variety. And you begin to see the complexity of all of this, and then, out of all of this, I had never seen the concept of yellow peril in its, when it originates. It originates at the turn of the century. It comes up in the very late, a German comes up, Gelbe Gefahr. The concept comes up in the very late 1890s, and it's directed primarily against rising Japan. So it's just emerged on the scene. It's clear Japan is going to be the dominant power. And we know that the yellow peril image, next to the plucky, westernized Japanese image, comes up this time. I have never seen it before in full color, the way those postcards illustrate. So you just go through an extraordinary series of yellow peril images, a stab in the back, the Pearl Harbor image back in 1904, the blood-stained Japanese generals. It just gets very, very harsh. And part of it, it's not really me reading it, because the language yellow keeps appearing in the captions themselves. And it's just ferocious. The Japanese are going to take over the world. And you just get this incredible burst of yellow peril type images of a kind. And you get images where the triumph of the yellow, it's actually Chinese. Because they're confused. It's the yellow races. So you're able to move into not simply to drive an analysis of yellow peril or racism at the turn of the century, but to really drive an analysis of enormous complexity of what racism amounts to, an enormous complexity of people's perceptions of themselves and others, because the Japanese side itself is very complex, and the Western side is very, very conflicted and complex as well. You know, now this one is... this is a European two card yellow peril series. The first one, the Celestial Empire, Germany, is the yellow peril and the European nightmare. And then it's the Celestial Empire, which is the old image of China as the great threat, because of its enormous population. But then it's the Japanese who come in, and only the Russians awaken to pick it up. You can see how the image is moving almost in one set. We float these images from peoples to peoples. It's the Japanese taking on the French, British, English, and Russians, and finally devouring the world. So these are the kind of things, if you go into the sites, they're much more dense even than complex. And yet, I think you can come out, I hope you can come out, more knowledgeable of understanding what we're talking about. And I think it brings us closer in many ways to the way history was experienced and certainly seen at the time. So these are some of the things we're wrestling with. We're now doing units on 20th century Japan, and we're introducing China, Korea, and the Philippines to the units. And we'll stay in the modern world, but try to do Asia in the modern world. But the notion is not to do Asia. The notion is a model for using the visual world and new technologies to do different kinds of technology and sculpture.
Right. So, at this point, we'll open up for questions and comments and suggestions, what people have. Anybody? Sir.
I got to come up for you. Sorry, Dan. I'm interested to know how this project affects your writing the book of the modern warfare. And you mentioned 9/11, you mentioned Pearl Harbor, and particularly three-dimensional and cinematic stuff. You know,
I've written on race and I've written on war. I'm actually a 20th century person, although all of this is 19th century. I'm very sensitive to perceptions of oneself and perceptions of others. I'm very sensitive to that. And I also, I mean, it's a subject in itself, it's a book in itself, but I am very sensitive as someone who grew up working on Japan, living in Japan, being Japanese people, a historian, to the way in which images and stereotypes can override rational planning and rational thinking. I think that the image and the stereotype usually wins out. Whether it's a delusion, a misrepresentation, or wishful thinking, usually wins out over the rational proposal. I think that's true. I think it's also true that you float images, Westerners' images of others are usually very contemptuous. And Westerners usually see others as traditionalistic, exotic, often erotic and exotic, there's often a feminization, or they're made into a monsters, and then we float them from one to another. So when I work on America and Arabs or Muslims, for example, I can float all the images. I see where there's sort of like there's a meta language, and we live with these meta languages or images. We just replace Chinese with Japanese and Japanese with Arabs and so on. And we are the others, the West and the rest. But I think one of the other things that really fascinates me now as someone who's wrestled with these things, as a conventional scholar with text but also with visuals, is the title of our project, Visualizing Cultures. And it's what I said at the beginning. That is to say, I don't think in terms of the West and the rest. And I don't think in terms of the rational West and the irrational others. And I certainly don't think in terms of simple good and evil or superiority and inferiority. I don't think that works at an analytical level. And so where this work really gets interesting is where you do transnational work. Perry, you can bring the images on all sides around. It's like Rashomon, the great movie. Can move around something, it doesn't mean there's no reality. All those perceptions are realities of their own, and there are realities in the middle, wars and atrocities and great accomplishments. But I find the more interesting cultures to be the comparative ones of whether war or peace or social justice or consumer culture or how people are receiving things. And I think we can do much better comparative work. It's not, I'm not talking relativism, the trappers who say it's all the same. It's not, but I think we can do much better work comparatively if we can see things from multiple perspectives and then try to make all of them. So it affects my work on war. For example, the book I'm working on now is called Cultures of War. It's not the West versus the Islamic fascists. It's war itself as a culture, and then trying to understand war by looking at it. In the case of the comic book, to World War II, 9/11, the terrorist attacks, America and Iraq, and so on. So, and a lot of this has come through my work in text over the years, but the work with the visuals has just gotten so rich now that I really think it's a major way to do pedagogy. And to, I guess one of the things I may be doing differently than you, what intrigues me now, is not giving structured images, you know, that are constructed by us, but showing people how we can analyze and work on things from multiple perspectives, and then giving them huge databases that we never had the opportunity to give them before, and saying, now go in there and come up with something original yourself. That's very exciting. As a teacher, you know, but also as a scholar to get in it and see things. And I really, you know, I've been doing it for many years. I've been a teacher for many years. The visual seeing this stuff, I really was able to understand things that I never, in different ways.
Yeah, I want to get, Tucker, go ahead.
Sure. I think you've done an amazing job.
I'm so glad.
You've done a really amazing job of describing the particular values of these visuals to you and your understanding of your field, and also describing how it could enhance the teaching and learning of the subject in general. I'm wondering if you've had much opportunity to get feedback from other faculty who may be using this as a teaching resource,
yeah,
and whether or not they've had similar experiences with their students. And I guess to follow on that, whether or not when you were designing the project, if you had an idea of evaluation in place to be able to compare it and actually see if it was making a difference in terms of student understanding of it.
Yeah, well, the answer is yes and no. Because we didn't do it, I didn't make a distinction between K-12 and university. At the beginning, we found out and had lesson plans made by people who were working K-12, which meant usually junior high and high school people. And they did lesson plans with focus groups, with tests, with workshops, and they trained 500 teachers, mm-hmm, who then go out and train other teachers over the last few years. And so there was a lot of feedback. And this we did with people who are very skilled in things that I've completely lost in. This unit meets the history standards, you know, 12, 17, 23. I haven't got the foggiest notion what they're talking about. But they really work with teachers and focus groups. And we got a lot of feedback, and we met a lot of large groups, and I would talk sometimes to really big conventions with hundreds of people. The feedback has been good, but anecdotal. But they are doing focus groups and getting responses and devising things. At the level of the university, it's pure anecdotal. People come up and say, well, I use this, I use that, I love your thing for this, the Russo-Japanese war stuff is great. People will write a note saying, oh, this site is wonderful, and then they ask you, what about this image, or what about that? But there has been, Scott may be able to answer that a little bit more. We have not systematically found out how many classes it's being used in.
Yeah, we're in the midst of
pushing out a broad evaluation of the project. And, you know, again, it's been 5 years of developing, and you know, it's a fertile test ground for us. So, again, as John said, a lot of it's been anecdotal, certainly in the university level. In the secondary education level, we have a lot more structured evaluation because it's been in the classroom. We're getting feedback from the teachers. And so, I mean, and to answer your question, it's the teachers in secondary schools, as we love it. I mean, it just they love it. The kids get in it. It wakes up a spirit in them. The teachers, I get comments from teachers constantly. I've got sheets of them that are just like, I've never had this much fun teaching my kids, you know, this subject area before. And as John said, other than that, the university level, it has been much more anecdotal. Similar stories, just we don't have the structured analysis to torture.
Now, one of the things that we did in the last, beginning of this year, up until now, I wrote most of the units. I was into it, and I wanted to set a tone and a standard. But beginning this year, we created a board, which is a real board, not a grant proposal board. It's a real board that we pulled in a number of academics from very, very, very substantial people and teachers from a number of universities. I don't have to go through them, but a number of universities. And we are more and more looking for outside people to do units. We're really anxious to get more and more people into doing the units. And it's a double-edged thing. One is that they'll do the units and it'll get known and it'll get used in the classrooms because they're great databases and great things. The second thing is, and this is what I mentioned earlier, if you go up to a scholar now and say, "Would you do?" Well, I'll take a younger person to be able to say, "Would you do it for us?" And what the answer comes back is, "I'd really like to, but I'm coming up for tenure or I'm coming up for promotion, and that is not regarded as serious scholarship. That's regarded as service." And then you get into very complex things. We really wrestling with this. Well, why is this not serious scholarship? The stuff I've written, I don't draw a distinction that this is not as serious as what I published in a journal or something. They say, well, the stuff that you're putting up isn't peer-reviewed. Well, then you've got to face that. But then someone says, why don't you do an e-journal? Well, we cannot do an e-journal with the kind of things we do. It takes us 6 months to even creating a unit, we're not an e-journal format, you see. So what we have here is a whole area that we have to redefine, or define. And I hope we will define in the next five, I hope you will.
Yeah.
Seriously, it's got to go on to another your generation, and that we will define that so that someone coming up will do PhDs based on visual materials and figure out how to publish online or some kind of a combination, and certainly stuff that is being done for us. We're putting stuff up that is terrific by other people. It's original. They're able to use any image they want, as many as they want, in full color, which they can't do in the print journal, which comes out in black and white with limited illustrations. Somehow the print journal has said, this is serious and that isn't. That's false. But it's a real challenge of redefining what we're doing. And I think we'll work it out in 5 or 10 years. That's one of the challenges I see now. So, you see, it's working in various ways. And the other thing is, I think what we've got to do now is, now that we're getting a density of things out there, is to get journals to review serious sites. Why not? We've never been reviewed in a single journal. But some of those are better than any article I could have ever published, or I could have published in the text. So we've got to teach editors, just as you had to teach people in museums to share the stuff because it's win-win. You have to teach people to say, some of that stuff is really serious scholarship and people should be, you know, should be involved. That's one of the things we'll try to do, but raising money is difficult. we relied on internal competitive grants at MIT for the first few years, and it's all soft. And it's hard. But one of the things I would like to do is award stipends or honorariums or something to people who create sites. So you not only can say we'll cover your expenses if you have to do something, but, you know, $5,000 or something if you take off a month in the summer. You know, I think it's a proper thing to do. And then one of the other things we're trying to do now is to bring in young scholars. And maybe what we're thinking is how to try to award money for young scholars to do this kind of work. That can go online, perhaps. But we train a generation. If I were to start over as a teacher, I would be very interested in training a young generation to do visual, serious visual research and work of this nature. But right now they're discouraged from it, or they just don't understand what's involved. So I think there's a lot of interesting things to do here.
Yeah, let's say another one. Yeah, go ahead.
Big voice.
I'm a PhD candidate in
do visual history.
But for now, I'm doing modern Japanese history, and my dissertation in part deals with comparing the occupations, American occupations in Japan, South Korea, and Okinawa.
So wonderful.
Last summer, I returned from 2 years of research in Japan. I had made several trips to Okinawa. But even before that, the first time I visited Okinawa, I remember was when they were rebuilding the Shuri Castle, I think in preparation for the 2000 summit meeting. And I remember visiting the castle and being told that it was rebuilt in its original splendor, all its glory. And I remember thinking, well, what was the original that they're talking about? Is this the castle that stood before it was destroyed in the Battle of Okinawa? Or is this before Okinawa's annexation, or Ryukyu Kingdom's annexation becoming Okinawa in 1879? Their visual images, I've never done this exercise on my own, but their visual images, it's a beautiful castle. I've taken photographs of it. But their photographs that American occupation photographers employed by the military government took after the war. They're photographs that were taken by Japanese during the war and even the pre-war period. And Matthew Perry himself, on his way to Japan, stopped at
a couple of the great lithographs of Perry at Shuri Castle. Yeah.
Right. So, I can imagine comparing these, putting them side by side, and you know, trying to see which original are they talking about now when they say the castle is being built. But after returning from my research, I've done PowerPoint presentations in classes that I gave for. And so I looked for photographs of Okinawa during the U.S. occupation period. And they're all over the place. There are images of the castle here and there. But part of the problem I have, and this is my question, is not being able to get enough information about the sources of the images that I did find online, that are presently online. Not knowing where they're coming from, perhaps being mislabeled, or you know, and so I don't want to be irresponsibly be using these materials in a course or in my own research. So,
well, anyway. I can't answer, of course, specifically until we went over the images together, but the question of attribution and knowing what you're using is a very serious one. And if there are things, if I can spin what you're saying in two directions, not quite what you asked, I write about the occupation of Japan. There are several things that I think you all should do if you're scholars now and doing books which have illustrations. And I write about the occupation of Japan, and I use many images in that. When you clear rights for in visual materials and publications, everyone now should write in boilerplate language for use in this book, in any translations, in any digital presentations that may be related to this book. You should clear your rights at the time. Now, concerning checking the authenticity of things, let me give you something I didn't even get into now. There are really political pitfalls in doing this. For example, we have sites up now on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but we don't have sites up yet on Japanese atrocities in China. And we can be, so people will say, well, what about the, you know, you're showing Japanese as victims, what about the victimization? And that is absolutely correct. And, you know, we're working on it. It's just that we wanted the Hiroshima and Nagasaki off and we have materials. The problem with modern photographs, one is getting permissions. The other is whether their provenance and where they came from. And when you get into war photos and atrocity photos, that's where you're on very, very perilous ground, because there are often mislabelings and misattributions and misidentifications in photos. And this is where the right wing comes in and really, really does damage. It happened about 5 or 10 years ago with a major exhibit of photos of the Wehrmacht, the German army, not the SS and that, engaged in atrocities against populations in Europe. And it was done, a scrupulous exhibit of 1,000 images done in Germany. And it was coming to the United States. It was coming to a major exhibit here in New York. And a Polish reviewer said, this is a sensational exhibition. I should note that there's 10 pictures in there, which it's not the Germans. Those are not German troops. It's been misidentified. He was not a hostile critic. The right wing picked it up and said, it's an exhibit of fake photos. The Japanese do identical things with photos. It's called Japanese atrocities in China. They say, those aren't Japanese troops. Or you said this was December, but they're wearing short sleeve shirts. Obviously, you don't know what you're talking about. And the right wing moves into that. I tried to get 4 different people to do a site on the Asia Pacific War, and I failed. So I'm going to do it myself. What I'm going to do, and this is something you might think of, is do images in memory. And I'm going to build the site where I know the pictures, I can put them in the core exhibit, but I'm going to build the site on existing sites. So I relate the images to memory, and then I will do the Nanjing sites, and the Comfort Women sites, and the Thai Burma Railway site, and Arizona, and the Americans, the British, the Australians, and the Japanese, which are both very anti-war sites, very critical, and right-wing sites. And use that, what that does is enable me to do something which, again, really requires structure. It enables us to show how images are used in memory. It enables us to throw out the images by identifying the most interesting sites, and it gets us off the hook for being responsible for the veracity or the clearing the IP, if there is any intellectual property, of those images. One of the other problems you have is if you Google a subject, I don't care what it is, you know, you get 20,000 responses. And there are just an enormous number of sites out there that are not worth spending your time on, and there are some really great sites in America. And what we need is not the librarian who lists every site on that subject. What we need is the person who can go in and guide you through existing sites. Imitate and say, this is really worthwhile, and here's why. You've got to be very scrupulous. And you've got to say if you don't know, you've got to say if you don't know.
We've only got time for one more. didn't cover this side of the room at all yet. Mark, go for it.
I just had a quick question. Thank you. When you're sending your students into these vast databases, or you're inviting them to look at details and photos, are you and Scott planning tools that will facilitate them capturing that and sharing it with other students? Letting them collect maybe 4 or 5 postcards to make a point, or capture a zoomed-in image of a photo?
No, I think the way we do it, incidentally, the course we teach is an undergraduate course, and it's a seminar, it gets 12, 15 students. What we try to do is take them into things, show the intellectual concepts behind this, show how we build sites, show the problems we face, the challenges, the questions we face, and then throw them into a database and say, now what would you do, and what visual narrative would you do out of that database? And they've all looked at all this stuff, and that's what's fascinating, because then you see how many different ways, you know, some it's MIT, somebody comes up with technology in the Perry exhibition, how a technological is portrayed. Someone else comes up with something entirely different. And then you begin, and then you can critique that approach, or the class can say, why didn't you use this image? What about that? And so it's a matter of giving them the frame of analysis, but I never thought what I'd say is it is just a way of doing analysis. And here's the way we struggle with this. Now what would you do with this database? Then the class is thrown off and they do projects of their own that aren't necessarily Asia.
And I think just to address the question of the tools, which was at the end of there, we're in the business, I think, and John and I were just discussing this on the way down. You know, we've developed some proprietary technology for creating databases within broader databases, ways we can go into the Museum of Fine Arts 400,000 images and just cut out a sequence of 2,000. But you know, to develop the tools by which students are going to really author and then publish and share and do that, that's not our business. You know, we're in the business of providing context for students and users to go in and look at something, you know, with a variety of different assets, a variety of different ways to go into that content, and providing them the access to a broader collection of those images. I could get lost in developing tools. I'd love to design tools. You design great tools. You know, I mean, that's where the museum and the university collaborations, I think, really come together. And again, that's a piece of what we do. And sitting at the nexus of sort of the scholars, the museums, you know, trying to bring them together and create a publishing platform. But in terms of developing specific and proprietary tools, it's not our specialty, and we don't want to be in that business. We want to produce content and provide the platform by which to publish that.
You know, on the other hand, for example, we have moved students into databases. Often the students will create projects out of books, so there's no way you can share them outside the classroom. But the ideal thing is to really get big databases that are in the public domain and throw the students into that. And then we've gotten some very good student things. Then you can post them on good student things. Then you can post them on the site as samples of work done by young people. But right now, like many of your things, they have to be held within the class because of IP things. Mm-hmm. What I would love to see eventually is where we have these huge databases, that people start to make them available. And then if the student takes, for example, if we hook into the Lauda postcards, the 20,000, and the student builds a really interesting paper on that, we just call up the MFA and say, can we post it? And because they know what we're doing, maybe there's something to discuss, but that's a good way to, and then they can feel they're really doing original stuff.
Okay, well, if everyone would join me in thanking John and Scott for this. Whatever refreshments remain, please grab those, and we'll see you in April. Thanks very much.
Excellent.
Terrific, yeah. Thank
Great.
You so much. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Very nice. Really compelling content. So interesting to get the stories that it's